So, we are now recording. Looks like we're ready to start. So, this class, as you know, we're dealing with the 3rd century, which would be roughly around 200 AD to, we're going to take it up to around 313 with the Edict of Milan. And the Edict of Milan, we'll talk about that near the end of the class, is when persecution officially ended and Christianity became, the status moved from an illegal religion to a legal religion. So the 3rd century, much like the 2nd century, the 3rd century, there's two great challenges that faces the church. And it's a wonder that it ever survived the 3rd century. And those two challenges would be, what would be one of them?
Persecution.
Persecution. And the other one is?
Heresy.
These are two great challenges. They helped shape the church in the early centuries and even actually for the centuries to come to a large degree. So the heresies primarily come from a Gnostic understanding of the world, or a Platonic view of the world. When you merge that with the faith, you end up with Gnosticism. We talked about that this past spring. But these heresies that began in the 2nd century, they continue to linger in the 3rd century. So today we're not going to talk about them, but they will come up. We're not actually going to review what we did last spring, because the things that will tie into the 3rd century, we'll just stop and kind of review them at the moment so that we can kind of keep the pace moving here. And persecution, of course, came from the Roman Empire. It wasn't strictly the Roman Empire. It also came from the citizens of Rome, neighbors, and the community at large, but mostly from the emperor himself. And today we're going to be getting into that more. So persecution produced martyrs, produced confessors, produced schismatics, produced apostates, and hermits, and also something called the lapsed, L-A-S-P-S-E-D. And heretics produced heresies. So so let's define martyr real quick. We'll just do a real quick definition. A martyr is somebody who, in taking a stand for the faith, they suffer what?
Death,
okay? A confessor is a bit different. A confessor, in standing for the faith, suffers what? Torture. They're not put to death, but they have, they are tortured, and many times they continue to bear the marks of that torture all through their life. A schismatic is what? Someone who calls it a schism. So a schismatic is somebody who separates from the Christian community or from the church at large and starts something different. So persecution did produce schismatics, schisms and schismatic groups. Apostate is somebody who does what in the face of persecution?
Denies
the faith, all right? And a hermit, did I say hermit before? Mm-hmm. Yes, hermit. Hermit is somebody who... What's that?
Isolates
themselves. Now, what's interesting is that, well, why do you think persecution produced hermits? We'll get more into this later, but why do you think persecution produced hermits?
Is it fear?
Yeah, that would be the obvious reason, but that's not the reason. It's not the reason. It's very interesting. We'll save it so that you'll come back. It's not the reason. Not the reason. All right, and then a lapsed is somebody who... What? Lapsed.
Denies the faith that comes back?
Yes, denies the faith in the face of hardship and then later wants to repent and come back into the faith. Okay, so today, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to start with persecution because that actually is what the 3rd century is best known for. The heresies that we find are really are ones that began earlier, but they continue to linger on. So a lot of the material that we'll be covering, even in the next 2 weeks, will tie into the persecutions that happened in the 3rd century. So we'll actually go back and start. We'll use this kind of like a review. We'll go back and review some of the points we covered this last winter, and then we'll just keep it flowing and go right into the 3rd century itself. Is that too cold? If it does, you'll just have to bear it and suffer. Are you cold? You can feel free to close it. So as we go through this, keep in mind that one of the reasons we're talking about isn't because I like to talk about gory things and people suffering, there is a side of cruelty to me that takes some sort of twisted fascination with all that. But that persecution really did shape the early church in significant ways. So as a review, we'll just start again by looking at the reasons for the why. And some of this will sound familiar if you were here for part one. What was it about the Roman Empire that caused emperors to lash out against Christians? And I think a lot of you are aware of a lot of this. So we kind of have to start with Caesar Augustus to get us kind of a running start into this. He was the first and the greatest of the Roman emperors, the model for everybody who followed. And he was the emperor when Jesus was born. So we're kind of putting this in a timeline here. And he was regarded as the salvation of Rome because he brought in something called Pax Romana, or Roman peace, which brought in law and order and renewed prosperity in the empire and military conquest and political victory and economic stability and even safe travel within the empire because of the law and order. So it was a very heavy hand, but it was also very successful. So citizens honored him for his great achievements. They deeply respected his throne, and they feared his power. And this fear and admiration carried on to the emperors that followed, and eventually this fear kind of became veneration. This respect and awe turned into veneration. And eventually, the citizens of Rome began to see their emperor as the embodiment of the state, an icon, if you will, of the empire itself. It's a totally different mentality than what we have here in the United States regarding our president, for instance. And this then, over the course of about a century, they attributed to him a sense of actual deity and began to offer sacrifices to him in their temples of worship or burn incense before the image. And this worship became a powerful force in support of the majesty and the prestige and the authority of his throne and of the great and powerful Roman Empire itself. So this was a unifying force. This veneration / worship was like patriotism. And because the emperor was the embodiment of the state, to worship him was kind of like what we do here when we say the Pledge of Allegiance or we sing the national anthem. We don't really think that much about it. They wouldn't think that much about it as far as being objectionable, because this was what you did to unify the country. And Christians, of course, refused to do this, and when they did, they were despised by their neighbors and the community. It would be similar today when we get irritated by athletes on TV who don't join in the national anthem because they're trying to make some kind of a political statement. So that same kind of feeling was the feeling that was that Christians were the object of back in those days. And then keep in mind that also during this time, people really didn't object to worshiping the emperor or showing him any kind of veneration, because all the religions at that time, except for Christianity and Judaism, were what? Yeah, they were polytheistic. They worshiped many gods. What's the big deal if you just add one more? And so the Roman emperor became kind of like a god in the sense that he represented the Roman Empire and was included in this whole menagerie of deities. So now there was one group that qualified for an exemption from all this, at least initially, and this, of course, would be the Jews. And this is only because it was extremely difficult to enforce. They couldn't. It was just a difficult thing to get the Jews to force them to worship the emperor. So they allowed them an exemption. The population of the empire, we might think of Jews as living just in Jerusalem or Palestine, just a small segment, but actually they were everywhere. They were spread out. They were not limited to one region. And they were ardent monotheists. It just would have been difficult to enforce. They were... Rome didn't want to, of course, risk unity in the empire with a showdown with them. Jews were also prosperous. They were actually well-organized, influential with non-Jews. And so Rome just chose to kind of back off and give them that exemption. But that only applied to Jews. However, Christians initially enjoyed the same exemption that the Jews did because Christians were seen as being just another part of the Jewish sect. And you see this in the book of Acts, where Jews will bring Christians before the authorities, and then the authorities will generally respond, "You guys take care of this matter yourself. We don't want to be troubled with it," because they would see it. They saw Christianity as part of Judaism. All right, so eventually Romans caught on that Christianity was not merely a sect within Judaism, but distinct, and thus toleration to them ended. And if you might recall from the last time, this became very clear when, after the fall of Jerusalem, the Jewish leaders expelled Christians from the synagogues and kind of kicked them out on their own, which is good for Christianity in many ways, but it also made them vulnerable to Roman persecution. So, all right, there were five major reasons Christians were persecuted by the Romans. Again, kind of as a quick review here, the first primary reason, of course, is that they refused to worship the emperor, because even though everybody said it was an act of patriotism, they saw it as idolatry. The Romans took this as an act of treason, and they had this kind of this mentality that it was the Roman emperor's guardian spirit, as they called it, that blessed the empire with prosperity in times of peace, and victory in times of war, and justice of law, and progress of the arts, and fertility of the herd, and fruitfulness of the field, and all these blessings. They saw that as coming from the people unifying behind the emperor. And to refuse to acknowledge this was to invite the wrath and vengeance of the gods. Also, Rome was suspicious of groups that met together, anything that might threaten the safety of the state. So Christians met weekly, and they grew rapidly, and they appeared to be well organized. In reality, they weren't, but Romans thought that they were. And they had this great loyalty and allegiance to their church leaders and obeyed them. And Rome was threatened by that as well, and they feared a revolt. And they just tended to distrust the whole thing. And among the citizens, they also suffered rejection and discrimination, and sometimes their neighbors would help the Romans hunt Christians down and turn them in, but not everybody, because Christians were involved in humanitarian efforts. Society benefited from their works, and so it was kind of like a mixed bag, much like it is today. You have people who hate Christians, people who are not Christians but do respect and appreciate them. And they have a lot of that going on at this period as well. Also, a third reason, and along with the charge that they hated the empire, they were also accused of hating mankind. We've talked about this too. Many refused service in the army or government, and that was frowned upon. Many Christians would not attend the public performances at the stadium, like the bloody gladiator games and things like that. It was just barbaric. Even events that were not objectionable, Christians oftentimes would not go because they opened up with invocations to certain deities, and Christians didn't want to be complicit in that whole thing. Also, this is interesting. Many refused to send their kids to the local schools, so they were seen as being kind of like separatists. And they were just not, you know, pluralistic like everybody else. They taught that Christianity was the only true religion, and that their Lord was the only true God. And so in a polytheistic society, this, of course, was a problem. And a fourth reason, there was, as you will remember, there's all kinds of rumors that flourished about the alleged immoral practices of their religious assemblies, because the communion service was a private ceremony. Just about anything that anybody claimed was going on in there was believed. And, of course, you might remember the whole cannibalism thing, because they ate the flesh and drank the blood. And even the Sunday gatherings were sometimes, they were accused of wild sex orgies because of the kiss of peace and all this emphasis on loving each other and that kind of thing. So it's much like today, where you take, you know, people who want to make mountains out of molehills and take things out of context and cast Christianity in a certain light will do so. And we have had hostile enemies from the very beginning. All right, and the last one's also interesting, is they were persecuted and frowned upon and discriminated against and harassed because they were considered to be atheists. And why were they considered to be atheists? Their God did not exist, because he could not be seen. There was no image of him. And And so they just mock them, saying that there is, you know, there is no deity behind everything that you're saying. All right, so, but again, the main reason was a stubbornness, and that was at the heart of the arrests, the trials, and the convictions. All this other stuff was kind of secondary, but it contributed to the mood of the day. Christianity was just not seen in the greatest light oftentimes. And the charge that they would be arrested and convicted on would be a charge that we have in the courts today, and it's called contempt of court. And it's just kind of a broad charge that anytime you show any sort of stubbornness to the authorities, especially to an authority in the court, then they just say, well, contempt of court. So, I mean, there's kind of a funny story here in Fort Wayne just a couple years ago. They brought a defendant in for his initial plea, and the judge said something to him about how do you plea, and he just said, F you. And the judge says, contempt of court, you go back and come back again with your plea in a year from now. So he just sentenced him to a year for doing that. So contempt of court is a pretty broad thing. You can use it for anything, anytime that you show disrespect. And that's how this was what Christians were accused of. Okay, so persecution spanned a pretty long era, 250 years from 60 AD to 313. It goes through various cycles. Sometimes it would last just a short period, maybe just a few months, sometimes maybe just a couple years, other times for a long period of time. And sometimes it'd be localized in specific areas, and other times it'd be universal. Sometimes it would be light. It would just involve maybe some imprisonment and harassment, maybe a seizure of property. And other times it would be pretty severe, like torture and death. And even those times when it would be somewhat relaxed, Christians were still harassed. They had a hard time getting jobs often and being accepted in their communities. So we'll now go back and, again, kind of like a review here, start with looking at some of these cycles under certain emperors. We'll just do the highlights here, and a lot of this will sound familiar, and then we'll go from the last part of the first century through the second century and then into the third century. We'll just kind of tie it all together so you can see the whole picture, because again, a lot of what we'll be talking about in the next 2 weeks will tie into this stuff. So Nero, of course, is the first emperor. I think you remember the stories here. He sat on the throne at a very early age of Christianity. This would be like from 54 to 68. So this would be, think, Acts 18 to the end of the book. He's the emperor. And unlike other emperors who came after him, he did not persecute Christians because he wanted their total allegiance, or he wanted to be worshipped by them. That whole concept was still evolving. And even if it had been required, Romans would have exempted the Christians on that at that point. So this is an altogether different reason. But what Nero does kind of sets things up for what follows in the decades to come. So in 64 AD, we have this fire that breaks out in Rome. We've all heard about this. And it was rumored that it lasted several days, destroying 10 of the 14 sections of the city. So this is no small thing. This is a huge, devastating fire. And it was rumored that Nero had set the fire himself so that when watching Rome burn, he would be, you know, seeing all this blaze and all the glory of this destruction, that would inspire him to write a great epic poem and all of this. He was a bit of a lunatic from what we understand. And feeling the heat of these accusations, he needed someone to blame. And two of the areas that had not been destroyed had a large population, but had a population of Christians. So he accused them of setting the fire, and that accusation stuck. He had them arrested. They were convicted. Some were crucified. Others were thrown to the lions, and a number of them were burned alive to serve as torches for his gardens at night. So he would mock them, saying, "So you want to be the light of the world? Here, be the light of my gardens," and would pour oil on, have oil poured on them, and then would burn them alive. We're not certain how long this wave of persecution lasted, but it was only in Rome, and it was during this persecution that Paul and Peter were martyred. And after Nero, we have about a 10-year period where Christians are generally ignored by the authorities. All right, all that sound kind of familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. So then in 81 AD, getting to the end of the first century, we have an emperor called Domitian, and he assumes the throne. The temple had been destroyed, of course, in the fall of Jerusalem 11 years earlier. He sees an opportunity. All that money that the Jews had been donating to the upkeep of the temple, he now wants that. And how compliant do you think the Jews were? What's their history in these sorts of things? They just say, no, we're not going to do that. And as a result of this stubbornness, he cracks down on anybody who follows Jewish practices. And so this starts a new wave of persecution. It was directed against both Jews and Christians because, in his mind, Christians are still part of Judaism. And he was the first emperor to officially demand to be called Lord and God. He made that the law. And those who refused, like Christians and Jews, they were punished. And it's under this it's under Domitian that John writes the book of Revelation while he's exiled on the island of Patmos. And some Bible commentators suggest that John was actually referring to Domitian when he was writing about the beast in Revelation 13. But that's another thing to explore at another time. All right, the next emperor worth noting is Trajan. Does that name sound familiar? He's pretty significant. As we enter the second century, emperor worship is now firmly established. Trajan makes the history books because he implements a policy that's observed for 100 years. He ruled that authorities should not waste time and resources chasing Christians down. It's not worth it. But if they are accused, they should be given an opportunity to either deny, they should be given an opportunity to worship the gods or not worship the gods. And if they don't, then they are to be punished. So there's not to be any anonymous accusations, has to be evidence. And they get a full pardon if they do worship the image of the emperor. And the punishment's he didn't really specify it, but the common practice was in that day was death. So about the next 45 years, there isn't anything that really stands out after Trajan, except that his policies continue to be the ongoing thing that other emperors implement. And we, in the middle of the century, around 161, we have Marcus Aurelius, and he's pretty common in history books, not because of his persecution, but because of other things in secular history books. But he becomes emperor. Unlike the previous emperors, who were pretty much cruel tyrants, full of themselves, he's a refined man. He left behind a collection of meditations written for his own private use that became a masterpiece of literature of that day. He praised human dignity, kindness, justice. He saw these as attributes, qualities that should be pursued, and he condemned hypocrisy and rebellion, so he's remarkably different. And in his writings, we find the common cliche that we use to this day, undertake every action in your life as though it is the last. You probably have heard that. That comes from him. And under such an emperor, you would think that Christians would enjoy a period of peace because there seems to be a camaraderie here, a common spirit that we share in common. But indeed, in his writings, he praises Christians for their willingness to die for their convictions. He respects them. But he is irritated by their stubbornness, and he refers to their stubbornness as just being illogical and unnecessary. And though he was considered to be an enlightened man, unfortunately, he was also superstitious. That's always bad when you got a powerful leader who's superstitious. And so he sought the advice of astrologers and seers and all of these sorts of people before he engaged in any serious undertaking. And during his reign, the empire suffered from numerous invasions and floods and plagues and disasters. And this is never good for the Christian. And his advisors told him that this is because what? Christians, they're to blame. They had invited the wrath of the gods because they refused to worship the emperor and all the other gods. Therefore, Christians have to submit. And Marcus Aurelius ordered for the severest outbreak of persecution yet. There's a record of Christians being held in a prison so crowded that they died of suffocation before the executioners could even get to them. So that gives you kind of a picture here. The persecution upon the church came so quick and was so unexpected that many fell away from the faith. There are a lot of apostates at this time. The church leader Irenaeus, you might remember him, he referred to this sudden and harsh attack upon Christians using the words, it was like a bolt of lightning. And in regards to those who caved in, he said, some of them weakened and left the womb of the church like a miscarriage. Those are the pictures that he used. And he himself died as a martyr under this emperor. So though in principle Marcus Aurelius followed Trajan's policy, he certainly pushed it further than it was intended. Though he did not order Christians to be hunted down, you might remember that he's the one who offered a very enticing reward for others who would turn Christians in. So bring me the evidence. If we convict them and he's put to death, then the reward is what? You get to keep their property. And that could be pretty motivating, right? Okay, a lot of this sounds familiar. So now, going to the last emperor of the second century, the last guy we're going to review is Septimius Severus. And at first, Christians were able to live at peace under his reign. In fact, he even entrusted the rearing of his sons to a Christian nurse. And it is reported that he had members of his family who were believers. However, the empire at this time again suffered from a series of violent civil wars. Just a lot of tension inside the empire. And the empire was not unified. And this unrest, he believed, could be resolved if there was religious harmony. And so his agenda was to bring all of his subjects together under the worship of the unconquered sun. You've probably heard of that deity. And this would be the unifying force in Rome, a merging of all religions into one. And who would have problems with this? Because everybody's so polytheistic anyway. And this new religion would accept all gods, but the worshipers had to at least acknowledge the sun and acknowledge the sun as who reigned above all, S-U-N. So Jews, Christians were not willing to comply. And in order to stop these two monotheistic religions, Septimius outlawed under penalty of death all conversions to either Christianity or Judaism. And this was in addition to the still existing threat of Trajan's policy. History records for us, what's significant here is that history records for us that this was a time when martyrdom was actually romanticized. And this is probably because church leaders were very ardent in encouraging their congregations to remain faithful to the faith. So they began to greet each other, believers on the street, may you gain your crown, which would be a way of saying, you know, may you honor the Lord with your death. May you gain your crown. And the anniversaries and deaths of martyrs would be observed, and they would be called their birthdays, so they'd be recognized year after year after year. This is the, you know, this is the year that our brother Rufus was martyred, and we remember him today, that kind of thing. So there's just a lot of this, I don't know what the word would be, appreciation and respect and going on. All right, so in fact, bishops oftentimes had to kind of step in and encourage Christians because they would actually turn themselves in or run into the fire, so to speak, and bishops kind of had to wait. Just wait until you're hunted down. Don't go turning yourself in. Okay, now we move into the third century. New material. Was the review helpful? Just shake your head whether it was or wasn't. Here we go. We're now at the year 235 to 236. So this short period, we've got a guy named Maximus, and the outbreak of persecution at this point is just directed specifically to Christian clergy. And what stands out here under him is that the bishops of Rome, Antioch, and Jerusalem are all executed. And these are the three top leaders of the church at that time. They are called patriarchs. And so he has them taken out. All right, next is Decius. This would be from 249 to 251, another short period. The persecution here is targeted in the west. It's Rome, Carthage, and Antioch. I guess that would be in the east. So those three areas. His main goal and everything was to restore Rome to her ancient glory, which, of course, is always trouble when you get a conservative into power in those days who wants to go back to the old times. That's not good news for the Christian. So the barbarians are pressing in on the borders more and more. There was a serious economic crisis. Everybody's complaining. Morale is real low. The ancient traditions associated with the classical times of the Roman civilization had all been forgotten. Everybody's complaining about why can't it be like the good old days. And so to a traditional Roman like Decius, The reason the glory days had passed was because the people had forsaken the ancient gods. And when they all adored the gods, things went better and the power of Rome increased. That's what the history books tell me, and that's what we need to go back and visit again. So we've got all this liberal curriculum going on in the public schools. We've got to get rid of that. We've got to get back to the old days. Thus, the Shias ordered everyone to worship the Roman gods. And to ensure that everyone would comply, is what stands out under his reign, is that we find he uses something called a certificate. It has to be validated by the Rome, by the civil government, proving that you had worshipped the gods, and this had to be in everyone's possession. Kind of like the vaccination card, I guess, like today. All right. Has to be in your possession. So whether you're walking down the street, you could get stopped. They might come knocking on your door. You got to produce evidence. You know, where are your papers? And you got to have it ready to show that you have been faithful to worshiping the Roman emperor. Those who did not have a certificate were considered outlaws and traitors. And some of those certificates exist to this day, I understand. Unfortunately, Christians were not prepared for this hardship. Many fell away from the faith. Again, a lot of apostasy during this time. They had, keep in mind here the timeline, Christians had enjoyed a season of peace for 40 years. So many had only heard about persecution. They had not seen it themselves. And they just weren't prepared for this hardship. Some obtained certificates illegally without actually worshiping the gods. They bought them on the black market, or they paid government officials to provide them. Others had non-Christians stand in their place to get them. Some certificates were forged, and others went ahead and went through the motions of worshiping the emperor, but just said, I didn't do it in my heart, I only went through the motions. God understands, surely he doesn't. What good can I be to the kingdom if I'm dead? Kind of idea. Now, since the goal of the Shias was not to kill Christians, but to promote the worship of the gods, there were not actually that many who died under him. However, many were tortured to great extremes. There was no this was no local or universal persecution. It was consistent all over the empire. There was no relief in it. And one of the results of this is that we now have a new title of honor for believers, and that is they're not now martyrs, but confessors. So they kind of took on this romanticized, magical, noble title where everybody really honored them. But so those who became confessors were highly respected by other Christians, and it was during this time that Origen, if you remember him, was imprisoned and tortured. All right, so 6 years later, after the death of Decius, we got Valerian. Just a three-year period, this persecution's focused on Rome, Spain, North Africa. He ordered for the confiscation of Christians' property, prohibited all Christian assemblies, and prohibited people from visiting Christian cemeteries. And finally, he issued an edict that that prescribed death for church leaders. And this period was fortunately short-lived because he was captured by the Persians, and as a result, the church enjoyed a period of peace and prosperity for the next 40 years. So again, we have these cycles where it's intense, and then it relaxes. And during this period of peace, a question comes forth that resulted in a very long and very bitter controversy in churches all over the empire. Because during this period of peace, those who obtained their certificates by worshiping the gods now want to do what? They want to come back into the church. So what do we do with Christians who obtained a certificate, who denied the faith and now want to come in? And what about those who had an opportunity to stand for Christ but found a way around by obtaining certificates illegally? What do we do with them? So this was called the controversy of the lapsed, and you can imagine that there was no shortage of opinions all the way around about this, strong opinions. And though there was peace from persecution during this 40-year period, there was not peace in the church. It was a very tumultuous time. The threat of division and schisms or the controversy of the lapsed proved to be just about as much of a threat as persecution itself. So we'll get more into that next week because we need to spend a little bit of time on it. And we'll be talking, next week we'll be talking about notable figures, and we have two notable figures in the third century who took, two church leaders who took opposite positions in this and became bitter rivals over it, and we'll talk more about that then. But the threat during this 40-year period under Valerian of torture and death did relax significantly under him. But then comes a guy named Diocletian. So we're getting now toward the end of the third century and kind of toward the end of this era of persecution. Under Diocletian, this would be from 303 to 311, it is everywhere. He made the empire stronger by reorganizing it, which in turn resulted in a renewed prosperity. He had placed the government on the shoulders of four emperors. So you have a junior and senior emperor in the east and a junior and senior emperor in the west. And upon the death of the senior emperor, the throne would automatically go to the junior. And the reason that he did that is because that would cut down, you know, snuff out the ongoing problem of civil wars over the question of who would succeed the emperor when he dies. So this was a good plan. Of the four emperors initially established by Diocletian, only Galerius, his junior emperor in the east, had shown any sign of hating Christianity. Diocletian was kind of so-so, but his junior emperor really hated Christianity. So the church seemed to be safe. In fact, Diocletian's own wife and daughter were Christians, and as were many of his slave servants and friends. And this general acceptance of Christians started to erode away when Galerius, his vice president, so to speak, convinced him that all Christians should be expelled from the army. And he made a good case. You can't trust them because they will not give their unconditional allegiance to the empire. In a time of war, you can't have potential traitors in the ranks. They will always listen to their church leader before they will listen to you. And then later, Galerius also convinced them of removing Christians from all the positions of responsibility in the empire, to be removed from all government jobs. And then that escalated to, you know, churches need to be destroyed, and Bibles need to be confiscated and destroyed, and all Christian literature. It just kept it going and going, and Diocletian just gave in to all of Galerius's reasonings. So many Christians refused to surrender over their sacred writings, and as a result, they tortured and were died. And this contributed, actually, to the formation of the canon in the next century. So see if you can connect the dots. How could this contribute to the formation of the 27 books of the canon?
They needed to know which texts were worth protecting.
Yeah, which ones are worth protecting. The Gospel of Thomas, I'll give that to them. You know, the Gospel of Matthew, I'm going to keep that hidden under the closet floor. Okay, so when it came, you know, during this long process of establishing which books are authentic, they would look back upon the seasons of persecution and say, which books did the bishops in particular protect at all costs? Because the bishops knew that they had that, you know, that they were worth protecting. They had that authenticity to them. All right. So one thing that Christians never want to see happen, and that is that fire broke out twice in the imperial palace. Galerius blamed the Christians. Diocletian bought that. He believed them. He became so furious that he issued a decree ordering all Christians to offer a sacrifice before the gods. His wife and daughter complied, as did many others, even a lot denied, including a lot of his friends, and they died. His friends, who were Christians, died as martyrs under his orders. And throughout the empire, churches were burned, Bibles, sacred writings were turned to ashes, many Christians were put to death. It was just really bad. The church was about to suffer the greatest, worst, and longest, indeed the bloodiest of all persecutions of the early centuries during his reign here. And unlike other waves, this was not limited to one particular region. It was universal, again, both east and west. So many Christians denied the faith. Some ran away. They fled to Persia. Many hid. Many were captured and tortured. Many were killed. An entire town and all the people who were predominantly Christian in that town, the whole town was destroyed. The Roman army itself was pretty much anti-Christian, and soldiers were given a license to do just about anything they wanted to do, and they did. the ancient church historian Eusebius writes, quote, the prisons which had been built for murderers and grave robbers, it's an odd crime, but murderers and grave robbers were now crowded with bishops, pastors, and deacons so that there was no room left for real criminals. And if a church leader did not have the marks of a whip on his body, he was suspected as having betrayed the faith and people wouldn't listen to him or accept him. And those who didn't die went through life maimed, blind, or disfigured by torture. Eventually, Diocletian became ill and weak. Galerius seized the opportunity to take his crown, even to the point of threatening his life. Immediately, Galerius used his superior army to threaten the emperors in the west and forced that emperor, the senior emperor, to surrender his throne to a man named Constantius Chlorus. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And to ensure his loyalty, Galerius took that guy's son as a hostage. Anyone want to guess who that guy's son is? His name is Constantius Chlorus, so he's going to have a son named Constantine. All right? So Galerius takes Constantine as a hostage to ensure loyalty from the West. And Constantine, however, was very popular by the Roman authorities and among the people, and there was opposition to Galerius about this abuse of power, and so there's a lot of tension now between the East and the West. Constantine manages to escape. His father dies, and refusing to obey Galerius, the military pronounced Constantine as the emperor of the West. And he had a junior emperor named Maxentius, and at this point, the empire was essentially divided, and Galerius was viewed as a rival. So neither Constantine nor Maxentius had any desire to persecute Christians, so they were safe in the West, but in the East, not so much under the rule of Galerius. Then, almost finished here, this is really interesting, abruptly and unexpectedly, hardy and healthy Galerius becomes deathly ill. And he was in so much pain, it was an intestinal thing, probably colon cancer, I don't know, he was in so much pain that he was willing to do anything to get relief. And he did not become a Christian, but he did acknowledge that his disease was most likely a punishment from the God of the Christians, as Christians had been telling him, had been warning him about, and he grudgingly changed his policy. So on April 30th, AD 311, this is a fascinating proclamation, he says this, quote, therefore, moved by our mercy to be benevolent towards all, it has seemed just to us to extend to the Christians our pardon and to allow them to be Christians again and once again to gather in their assemblies. In return for our tolerance, they will be required to pray to their God for us, meaning him, for the public good and for themselves so that the state may enjoy prosperity and may live in peace. So he was desperate to get relief from this pain. But he apparently wasn't healed because he dies 5 years later, still probably pretty miserable. Unfortunately, when he died, the one who came into power started persecutions back up under him. But a big political change was about to take place. We won't get into all the details, but through wars, threats of wars, political maneuvering, perhaps even intervention from God himself, just to summarize it, Constantine eventually became the emperor over the Western Empire and the Eastern Empire. And in fact, Constantine believed that the God of the Christians had granted him this victory, this position. But in the midst of that whole tug of war, there was a point before he became the emperor over all that he convinced his rivals to join him in what was called the Edict of Milan, which you've heard me talk about. So persecutions at this point officially ended. The churches, cemeteries, Bibles, everything else is returned to the Christians. And we have to remember this. Christianity at this point does not become the official religion of Rome. That does happen, but that happens later. But under Constantine, its status has changed from an illegal religion to a legal religion. So next week, we'll talk about the influential leaders of the 3rd century, including Cyprian and Novatian, who are the two polarized who represent the two polarized camps of what to do about the lapsed. So in the meantime, you might be thinking yourself, how would you handle that question? Somebody who's repented, do you give them a second chance, let them come back into the church, or do you say, no, you denied the faith, that's too much to accept. Or is there some other middle ground? So be thinking about that, and we'll get into that next week. All right.
Thank you.
Question. Yes.